Thank you, Sangsik, and thank you everyone for coming. And it's a great pleasure to be talking at Perimeter about our recent work. Yeah, and as Sangsik mentioned, I'll be talking about solvable models of measurement-induced criticality. And this is work that I've done in collaboration with Shaokai Jian, Gregory Benson, who are both postdocs currently at Brandeis, and Brian Swingle, who is my thesis advisor at the University of Maryland. And these are based on two papers that we posted this year, and one of them in the last couple of months. All right, so let's get started. And feel free to ask me any question during the talk. Okay, so let's talk about first a very basic exercise in quantum mechanics, which is about entanglement and its interplay with local measurements. So imagine we start with two qubits, which are both initialized in the zero state. And so that's a product state in the beginning. And now it's acted upon by a unitary. It may be considered to be generated by a Hamiltonian, which is connecting these two qubits. And after some time, so the unitary will generate a state, which is a superposition of these different bit strings with different coefficients. And as a result, the entanglement entropy, say, characterized by this von Neumann entropy of the reduced density matrix of a single qubit will be positive after some time. So this generates some correlations, which is captured by the entanglement of the reduced density matrix of a single qubit. Now, on the other hand, if after that unitary, we did a measurement, we did a local projective measurement on one of the qubits, so say measure in the computational basis, so then the state would be either the zero state on the first qubit with some superposition of states on the other qubit, or it will be one on the first qubit and some superposition on it, which means that the correlation or the entanglement between the two states will now be zero after the projective measurements. And even if we average over the two possibilities, the average entropy over the two possibilities will be zero. And a similar situation might arise when we have weak measurement instead of projective measurements, where we suppose we wanted to measure the state on the first qubit. Instead of actually projectively measuring the state, we couple it to an auxiliary qubit, and we do the measurement on that auxiliary qubit. So in this case, we actually do a weak measurement on our qubit, on our red qubit. And even though it's not a projective measurement, still the entanglement between the red and the blue qubits will be generically reduced. And this is because by this process, we are actually increasing entanglement between the red qubit and the auxiliary qubit. So by monogamy of entanglement, the entanglement between the red and blue qubit will have to reduce. So typically we see that generic unitaries will create entanglement and local measurements reduce entanglement. And so imagine we have these two circuits, these two extreme cases where we just have a circuit which is generated by some unitaries, which are some unitaries are acting on local qubits, on qubits locally. So imagine this brickwork circuit. So after some time, which is beyond the Lee-Robinson time or the scrambling time, any subregion of the circuit will have volume law entanglement, which means that suppose I look at these two qubits, these qubits will have generically correlations. Each of these qubits will be generically correlated with outside. So then any subregion, if I look at the entanglement, this will be proportional to the area or the number of qubits the number of qubits within that volume. On the other hand, in this qubit, in this circuit, suppose I did a local projective measurements for each of these qubits at the end. So at the end, we know that we have to get down to a product state. So that means that at the end, we have no entanglement between any qubits. And we have a very pathological case of an area law entanglement, where the entanglement is at most proportional to the area or the number of, the area of the subregion, the perimeter of the subregion in this case. So what was realized recently over the last couple of years is that we can have an interplay between the effects of measurements and scrambling unitaries, where we get a phase transition in the entanglement properties of the states generated by the circuits. And just an introduction to this is a picture for this is given by in the circuit, where we have say a locality preserving scrambling unitary, which is this blue blob, and suppose we intermittently measure some qubits at during the course of that evolution, and these are these red crosses, and as we increase the frequency with which we measure, as we increase the number of measurements, then we go from this scenario to this scenario, and there is a sharp phase transition in certain cases from the final state being volume law-like to area law-like, and the transition occurs with increasing probability of measuring the qubits in each layer of the circuit. So this has been a phenomenon which has been identified in the past 2 years, and it has started various avenues of work which builds on these ideas and tries to find these ideas in different contexts. So my goal is to study this phenomenon, and in particular, my goal is to try to understand these phases, these entanglement phases of the phenomena that I described, and the critical properties of the phase transition between these two phases analytically. Can we come up with an analytical model which explains the phenomenology of the phases as well as the critical properties of the phase transition? And also, can we come up with other dynamical phases if we add other ingredients? For example, in this talk, we'll also talk about long-range interactions in the unitaries. What happens when we add long-range interactions in the unitaries? Are there other phases possible? And does the phase transition, the critical properties change, and so on? And we'll try to answer those questions within the analytical framework that we'll develop. So taking a step back, the reason why we might be interested in the study of the phases and the phase transitions is that the study of condensed matter is often one of the organizing principles of studying condensed matter is the study of phases of matter and phase transitions between them. And we are all familiar with classical phase transitions and phase diagrams of, for example, water, or say quantum phase transition at zero temperature, between ordered state and disordered states in various and the properties of the quantum critical fan, and so on and so forth. And these are very powerful tools for us to understand properties of matter, and as well as study properties of matter even outside the critical phases. But at the same time, the equilibrium phases of local or simple Hamiltonians cover a very small part or small corner of the whole Hilbert space. And this comes from the fact of, because the Hamiltonians are local or simple typically, so then the ground space of the low energy states are also simple. And so they simple in some sense, in the sense that the number of the possible states are not as large as the total Hilbert space, which is available to all the states. But now the question is, suppose we go beyond the ground states or low energy states and go into a dynamical regime, then what are the other interesting possibilities that we can get? And that's one of the guiding principles why our goals that we want to address in this kind of question, in the kind of questions that we ask here. And two relatively newer paradigms of thinking about this has come from quantum information and quantum simulators, where we now have well-controlled quantum systems, atoms, ions, electrons, and different several other quantum simulation platforms where experimentalists have very direct control over the interactions and the measurements and so on of individual quantum particles, or also collective quantum systems. And because of the amount of control that is possible, then it naturally we can think about dynamically generating quantum phases using quantum circuits and generic non-equilibrium or out of equilibrium processes. And also we can also hope to study or hope to distinguish phases through their entanglement and even the dynamically produced entanglement and their phase transitions within these different phases. So the measurement-induced phase transition falls in this arena, and that's why it's an interesting phenomena which goes beyond the study of the ground space of local simple Hamiltonians and goes maybe a little bit away from the states which are possible here. All right, so with that motivation, this is my outline of the talk. I pose the question, So I'll start by setting up a purification transition setup, and then I'll introduce a model that we study, and I'll show how a particular variant of this model or a particular version of the model is amenable to analytical calculations. And then we'll go on to study how to actually solve or analytically access the phases and the phase transition in this model. And then towards the end, I'll also introduce long-range couplings and other ingredients to actually get to other interesting phases. So let's start with the setup. All right, and feel free to ask me any questions if you have at any point. Okay, so let me start by setting up the measurement-induced purification transition version of the story, which is very similar to the circuit that I drew before, which shows the phenomenon of measurement-induced phase transition. But now we have these system qubits, which is what I'm pointing at, and they are initialized in some entangled state with a bunch of reference qubits, which I have denoted by R. And so the system qubits are undergoing a circuit, which is the unitary interspersed with local measurements. And the point is, so initially the system is entangled with the reference. So the system or the reference are not in a pure state. They're generically in a mixed state. Now with an unit, with just an unitary transformation or unitary evolution of the system, the reference is still a mixed state. The reference still remains in a mixed state because it doesn't kill the entanglement between the system and the reference. But on the other hand, if I locally measure the system, for example, if I measured all of them, then generically the final state will be a product state here, and so which will destroy the entanglement between the system and the reference. And so we will get now a phase transition. If we tune down the frequency of measurements, we'll get a phase transition on the purity of this reference. And the purity of the reference is the trace rho squared, the reduced density matrix squared. And this can also be expressed in terms of the second Reni entropy, which is the exponential of the minus second Reni entropy is the purity. And in generically, we have the Reni entropy of this reference, which is given by this definition. And we see that if there is no measurement, then this Reni entropy is maximal if we start with the EPR states, for example. But if we measure and we project down to some product state, then the entropy between the system and the reference will be zero. So what was noticed pretty soon after the entanglement transitions were discovered that this also paints a complementary picture of this phase transition, where as you tune up the measurement rate at some polynomial timescales, polynomial in the system size, the purity of the reference is less than one, is some less value which is less than one, and then this but beyond some critical rate of measurement, the purity is generically one. So there is a phase transition that happens at this measurement rate. And in terms of the Reni entropy, the phenomena is, so if I plot the Reni entropy as a function of time, in one phase, it goes to zero in polynomial timescales. In the red case, this is the mixed phase or the equivalent of the volume law phase in the entanglement transition with this case is the mixed phase. Here we have some non-zero value of the Reni entropy, which persists over polynomial timescales. But of course, because we are measuring the states, and then after infinite time, there would be enough measurements done which would actually destroy the entanglement between the system and the reference. So at exponential timescales, this entropy again goes down to zero. So the phase transition happens at this polynomial timescale, where we get some zero entropy versus some non-zero entropy between the system and the reference. So this is the setup of the measurement-induced purification transition, and let us now introduce a spherical Kao model for this MIPT, where we and these are these all-to-all Brownian circuits that I'll introduce, and we'll show that these models can actually be analytically studied. So now we throw out all sense of locality in the system, and we consider a single cluster of spins. These green are qubits or spins, and there are n of them in a single cluster. And we imagine that the spins are subjected to alternate layer of unitaries and measurements. The unitaries are the blue stacks, and the measurements are the red stacks. And so for half the time in a particular time step, we perform a scrambling unitary, and for half the time, we do some measurement. And the unitaries are two-body interactions, as I'll explain what kind of interactions we choose, while the measurements are single-body measurements. So this has the ingredients that we wanted to have. And so the scrambling unitary is generated by a random Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian is all-to-all, so it takes each qubit and couples it to each other, every other qubit, through this kind of interaction, where the interaction has couples between all different poly strings, all different poly operators for each qubit. And the interaction strength is chosen to be time dependent, and we'll choose a particular version of this time dependent Hamiltonian, which allows us to do analytical calculations. But one can think of this Hamiltonian as just generically coupling to any two qubits in this cluster. For the measurement part, we do a slightly convoluted thing in the beginning, but that also helps us in analytical calculation. Suppose we want to measure this particular string of poly operators. So this is a single body poly operator. This is on a particular spin, particular qubit, and we want to measure this particular vector on the Bloch sphere. And to measure that particular this operator O, we couple the state of our system with some auxiliary qubit, with some unitary, and then we measure the auxiliary qubit. This is a version of the weak measurement. Furthermore, we post select on the auxiliary qubit. So what it does essentially is it does a non-unitary transformation on our state. So which is given by some operator, which is just an exponential of a matrix on the state itself. So this is a non-unitary transformation, which captures the measurement part, but because we are post selecting, we actually have a deterministic evolution of the state. So I'll explain a little more about the effect of post-selection on this. Because we are post-selecting, we are forcing the result of the measurement, or we are only doing all statistics on the results of measurements that we want, in some sense. So the analytical progress comes from taking all these the time-dependent Hamiltonian to be random. So we have this the strength of the coupling, which is J, at different times, which choose them to be independent at each time. And this is some we can think of some Gaussian random numbers. And similarly, the operators that we are measuring, we also choose them to be random at different times. So this randomness allows us to integrate out the randomness and allows us analytical progress. This is very, very similar to mean free spin glasses or SPIKE models, as we'll see in the next slides. So are there any questions about the setup? All right, so let's go forward. Let's talk about what we are trying to calculate. So we saw that for measurements, if we keep track of the different trajectories, then a density matrix of the state undergoes an evolution, which is given by the Krauss operators. The Krauss operators there are different operators for each measurement outcome. But now, since we are choosing this post-selected measurements, so post-selected trajectories, we have a particular fixed non-unitary transformation. So we get rid of all the Krauss operators but for one, and this generates a fixed non-unitary transformation, resulting in an unnormalized state. So this rho t at the end of this transformation is an unnormalized quantum state. And suppose we want to calculate the Reni entropy, which is, and in this equation, I'm just looking at the second Reni entropy. So then we have a trace rho squared, but we also have to take the ratio of this with the normalization factor that comes from the fact that because this is not a normalized state, we take the log and then we average, if you want to average the Reni entropy. And so this averaging is now over two different things. So we have to average over the measurement trajectories, and this is the A's, and there's also the measure, they're also averaging over the randomness of the circuits. These are captured by J. In this problem, we have simplified the problem a lot more by just doing post-selection and just focusing on the averaging over the randomness of the circuit. Now, this is a very hard thing to calculate because this is an average of ratios, and the averaging is done actually outside the log, and this is a pretty hard, this is a hard thing to calculate analytically, and we have to rely on numerics. We instead calculate a related entropic quantity, which is the quasi-Reni entropy. It's a quantity that is easier to calculate analytically. It's a ratio of the average. We take the average separately and then take the ratio. And a priori, it is not clear whether these two things are related, but one can show that if I take the quasi-Reni entropy and take the n equals to one limit, then actually it is the same as the von Neumann entropy averaged appropriately.
Is there any expectation that these things are going to be self-averaging in the large n limit? Because I think you're going to take a large n limit, right?
Right. We will take the large n limit, and there's an expectation that if we can set up the problem correctly, then we can get a self-averaging quantity. But actually, we'll show that the thing that I'll talk about next is not a self-averaging quantity. So these are distinct quantities in that case. We need to somehow introduce more randomness in terms of multi-body measurements to actually make them self-averaging. So a priori, these are very distinct quantities, and there's no reason why they have to be the same in any model. But one thing to note is that as experiments, if I just wanted to simulate this, like I just wanted to calculate or extract this quantity, these two quantities from experiments, both are equally hard in the sense of the number of quantum resources required to simulate either of them are the same. And this, the quantities only differ by some classical post-processing extra steps that are required for this quantity. So, since they're equally hard, we really, there is no realistic way in which we can actually do the exact, we can extract the exact many-body quantity from an experiment. And we want to actually look at this quantity, which is the interesting quantity, but we are looking where the light is, rather. So we are trying to study this quantity, which itself is an interesting quantity, and seeing what are the lessons that we can take from studying this quantity. And at the end, I'll also comment on how we can proceed from studying this quantity to this quantity, but that's also work in progress. All right, so now that I've set up the problem or model, let's go on to try to solve try to sketch how this problem is actually analytically solvable and how to extract the interesting quantities that we are interested in. So let's first focus on the Reni two entropy, and I'd like to sketch out the replica structure of this quantity. So writing it out, the quasi Reni entropy is defined such. So we take the ratio of the averages. Let's focus on the numerator for now. So we have a trace rho squared. This can be represented in a doubled Hilbert space. So we have two copies of the density matrix, and we implement a swap operator at the final time. And this can also be written in terms of if I just wrote out all the different non-unitary evolutions acting on the rows. So this can also be written as V rho V dagger, and then V rho V dagger. These don't cancel out because it's a new non-unitary transformation. And so we end up with four copies of the time evolution. So we have end up with four copies of V, which are coming from two copies of the Hilbert space. And each copy of the Hilbert space are acted upon by two copies of the unitary. And the swap operator appears. So if I just now focus on the numerator, I have four copies of the time evolution. So there's V, V dagger, V, and V dagger. And the swap operator swaps between the first copy and the second copy in this particular way. We have a time, we have a coupling that couples the first two replicas with the second two replicas at the final time. So we have a coupling which goes like this. So two is connected to three and one is connected to four. And the initial state is we can think of this as a quantum mechanics problem where there is an initial state which is this, which is evolved by this four copies of the time evolution operator. And now we are taking the expectation value or the overlap with this final state, which is given by the swap operator. And so from this schematic, it becomes clear that the only thing that is separating the numerator and the denominator are the boundary conditions. So we have in the bulk, we have four copies of the time evolution operator, and only the way these replicas are coupled at the final or the initial time, actually in this case, only the final times, determine whether we are looking at the numerator or the denominator. Furthermore, there is an inbuilt replica permutation symmetry in this problem, in the sense that the way I have labeled these different copies, 1, 2, 3, and 4, there is no reason why I had to label it like that. I could very easily flip between the different labels. For example, I can easily flip between 1 and 3. This would be just replacing the label of this V and this V. And the setting of the problem should not depend on that labeling. Similarly, I can extend between 2 and 4. And even I can do an exchange between 1 and 2 as long as I do a time conjugation on the circuit. So there's an explicit replica permutation symmetry which is acting on the system, which is two copies of the permutation on two elements. And there is a semi-direct product with the Z2, which is the taking care of the time conjugation as long as when we flip between the two copies of the circuit acting on the same Hilbert space. So we have this explicit replica symmetry, permutation symmetry in this problem. So going ahead and doing the disorder average, the reason why we introduced this random Hamiltonians is that we can now do disorder averaging. So remember, we have each of these circuits at different times they are all independent numbers, but because they are copies of the same circuit, they have to be the same on along each of the circuits. So any intra replica coupling, so there is coupling between two spins, for example, in this this circuit or this copy, has to be the same across all replicas. So now when we take the disorder averaging over the different couplings and we do a simple Gaussian integral, we end up with an expression which is like this, where we have an action. So this is an action. This is an action in the exponent. So we have an action which is proportional to n, and also an action. And for the unitary part, we have an action that couples different spins in different replicas. So now U and V in this action refer to different replicas, and they are coupled together after we do the disorder averaging. So in essence, what is happening is once we do the disorder averaging, now there is coupling generated between the replicas. So any intra-replica coupling is now transferred into an inter-replica coupling bit of its different spins. And this is a quadratic. So this coupling is between two spins, the same spin between two different replicas, and there is a square. And this comes from the fact that we have two-body interactions in the unitaries. And similarly, for the measurement part, once we do the disorder averaging, we get a coupling between two different replicas. But now this is only a linear term; there is no square here, and that's because the measurements are single-body measurements. So in essence, we have integrated out the disorder in the circuits, and we are left with this coupling in the replica space. Okay. So we can do our usual trick now by introducing Hubbard-Strachanowitz fields, which are coupling different replicas, which I've denoted by F. And so what we get is that the numerator and the denominator in the quasi-Renyi entropy can be expressed as a form of a path integral. So this is in this first expression, I mean, the path integral is over spin coherent path integrals. And there's an action which has a prefactor of n, and there's this, the action terms are given here. And this is a path integral with boundary conditions. So we have to remember there is a boundary condition that determines what state we start with and what state we end up with. And by the trick of introducing Hubbard-Sartorovich fields with some pretty non-trivial effects on the boundary conditions, we can at least schematically write this as a functional, as a path integral over these collective fields G, which are these mean field type fields connecting different replicas, and the Hubbard-Sartorovich fields F, which are decoupling the interaction in the replica space. And now that we have an action with an n in the prefactor, we can do a saddle point calculation by taking the large n limit, and we can. This would be, of course, a bulk study. Like I'll not be keeping track of the boundary conditions, but we'll see that this also we can actually read out what happens at the boundary effects from the study. Okay, so this trick is similar to SYK, what we do in SYK or in mean field spin glasses, and going forward, after some pretty non-trivial calculations, we find that if I look at the level of the saddle points, then for a measurement strength which is lower than some critical measurement strength, and this critical measurement strength is just this is some number that we can extract, there is a replica symmetry breaking. So a Z2 subgroup of the replica symmetry group that I talked about is spontaneously broken, starting from this action, which I've not really written out the form of the action. A Z2 subgroup is spontaneously broken. And as we see, there's a Mexican hat type potential now here. While for gamma greater than gamma C, we have that replica permutation symmetry is preserved. And the replica symmetry breaking field is exactly this F1, this combination of the Hubbard-Sartorovich fields, which connect 1, 2, 3, 4 to 1, 4, 2, 3. So you see the replica permutation between the two copies of the Hilbert space is actually spontaneously broken at the level of the saddle point when I look at measurement strengths which are lower than the critical measurement strength. And this is similar in a sense to the replica symmetry breaking in spin glasses, where but now in that case there are no real replicas. You introduce different replicas and then you introduce the replica trick and you take the n equals one limit. But in this case, what I've explained until now is actually real replicas where I have real copies of the Hilbert space. But there is at least a superficial connection between there's a notion of replica symmetry breaking, which got recognition this year in the Nobel Prize. But there might be actually a deeper connection, which might be apparent later with more further studies, but I just wanted to flash that.
Sorry, could you clarify this idea of real replicas versus not real replicas?
Right. So in this case, we actually have two copies of the Hilbert space because we're looking at the Renyi 2 entropy. So we have rho squared, and so rho is acting
each of. Right, but if you actually wanted a von Neumann entropy, then in that sense, this would still be like a replica trick.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll actually talk about that a little bit at the end. That will indeed will be not a real replica, and we'll have to take the replica limit. And in that case, if the replica symmetry breaking still persists, it's more closer to the notion of the replica symmetry breaking in mean field spin glasses. All right. So close to the critical point, close to the symmetry breaking point, we actually end up from a complicated action, which I have not written down here, to a simple 0+1 dimensional Ising field theory, because it's a Z2 symmetry breaking transition, which is given by this particular action where there's a phi to the 4 term and there's a mass term, which goes to negative. And that's a transition. Going to zero is a transition. So we get down to a very simple 0+1 dimensional using field theory, starting from a microscopic model that we with some properties. So I mentioned that there are boundary effects play a very important role, and let me just clarify what I mean by that. So the numerator and the denominator, so the trace rho squared or the trace rho whole squared, only differ by the swap operator, and that effect of the swap operator actually translates to the phi fields that I mentioned, in the fact that at, so this is as a function of time. So as I go from zero to say at final time, that phi operator has to go from a positive number to a negative number. Okay. So this can be seen by from the effective Hamiltonian effective model, effective action that I wrote down, that simplifies to be like a single spin problem in the presence of a magnetic field, and the effect of the two different boundary conditions translate to the magnetic field going from positive to a negative. And because of, and at gamma less than gamma critical, now we have two saddle points. We have two symmetry broken saddle points. The saddle point is not exactly at zero, but at plus minus root delta. So now, because of the boundary conditions, the configuration of the field has to go through an instanton type configuration, where it goes from one saddle point to the other saddle point in some intermediate time. And the reason why an instanton configuration is preferred here, because now this instanton can move freely as long as it's not too close to the boundary conditions, and that gives it an entropic enhancement. So this is why this kind of configuration is preferred when I keep track of the boundary conditions. And this is a heuristic argument. We can go back at the action and try to do a numerical gradient descent and try to see what is the preferred configuration, and this is what it comes to. Now, on the other hand, when the symmetry is preserved and the saddle point is exactly at zero, now because of the boundary conditions for the numerator, all, again goes from the positive to a negative number. But now, because of the configuration being zero, it can spend most of its time at zero, and there is no extra instanton configuration like in the gamma less than gamma critical case. So what at the end we see is that from just this simple picture, we see that the purity, which is the e to the minus s2, when I take the average, is actually given by, and for gamma less than gamma critical, is given by an exponential of minus n with an extra instanton factor, because this is the only thing that is differing between the two different the quantities in the numerator and the denominator, and there is an extra factor of t which is coming from the freedom of the instanton to move around. And now this is for t polynomial time scales, this is a number which is less than one, and this is the purity less than one phase that we wanted to access. But on the other hand, for gamma greater than gamma critical, we have the bulk configuration and also the boundary configuration in the numerator and the denominator actually cancel out, which gives out a purity of one exactly. So at polynomial time scales, we have actually recovered this phase diagram from analytical treatment. Furthermore, from the zero plus one dimensional Ising field theory, we can read out what is the scaling of this instanton action near the critical point. And this can be worked out pretty easily. And this would be some gamma C minus gamma raised to 3/2, which gives us a Reni 2 entropy, which goes as gamma C minus gamma whole raised to 3/2. So this 3/2 gives us a critical exponent for the Reni entropy near the critical point, this is just starting from the zero plus one dimensional Ising field theory. But I mentioned that there is this time enhancement factor because of the entropic freedom, but this also actually explains what happens at late time. So what if we waited for times which are greater than exponential, which are in exponential timescales with the system size? And in that case, the entropic factor dominates, and we can have multiple instanton configurations which are dominating now, and these instantons will proliferate. So what happens at the end is that the replica symmetry is restored in the saddle point calculation, and we end up with a purity of one. And so this explains from this instanton proliferation picture, this explains what why at exponential time scales we have late time purification. So going back to our original picture, so we now have an analytical model for what happens at the different phases, purity less than one, purity greater than one, purity equal to one at polynomial timescales. And we also explain the critical properties near this critical point for this purification transition problem. And we also show that at late times, even in the mixed phase gets purified. And that happens in our model from this very simple instanton proliferation picture.
Sorry, quick question. Yeah. Is there a sense for which this is a sharp transition instead of a crossover, which takes very long time, or?
Right, it's I think an order of limits question actually. So in case, if we take the n goes to infinity limit first, then there is a, there's a sharp transition.
I see.
Which goes from these two phases because we'd never access this exponential time scale.
I see, okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Another question?
Yeah.
What's the intuitive picture that connects the replica symmetry breaking and the purification transition? I mean, not so detailed, but even more intuitive. And another question is, how do I see that the crossover behavior happens at the scale of exponential of n?
Right. So for the first question, actually, it's a question that I don't have a very good answer to. What is an intuitive reason why there is a replica symmetry breaking? But it is something that has been coming up in different contexts as well. So even in the random unitary circuit cases, the analytical progress that has been made for hybrid dynamics, that is also a replica symmetry breaking or an unbreaking transition. And I think I think we still really don't really, I mean, at least according to my understanding, we don't really have a very good intuitive understanding of why this happens. So at the level of calculation, it is clear what is happening, but why is there an, what is the intuitive picture behind this replica symmetry breaking is not very clear to me at least. So that part I can't really answer. But for the second part, you're looking at what is the exponential and how do we distinguish between the exponential between the different properties at exponential and exponential time scales? So at the level of the saddle point, it won't be very easy to distinguish, except that we know that if we wait for exponential times, then even and at finite n systems, but just from numerics, we see that the entropy actually does not remain constant; it goes down to zero, and so if we don't take the n equals to infinity limit, then we have the subleading. We have the subleading corrections, and in fact, this instanton configuration or the multi-instanton configurations all can be understood as a subleading n feature, which just gets calculated in this particular way. So what I have painted is a very heuristic picture of what happens at exponential n, but exactly what happens we'll have to go through the comparison of the different actions and see mm-hmm. at a particular time in n.
Mm-hmm. And can we just go back one slide?
Yeah.
Yeah. So from this picture, how do I know why is the red figure more important in that time scale? In principle, it can also happen in the left figure, right? The multiple instances.
Right. So what will happen is that there will be different terms in this expression. So there will be a t into exponential minus n. There'll be a t squared, which is with an exponential of minus n but two instanton. So because there will be two instantonic configurations, so each of them will cost some value, but there will be an enhancement coming, which is a factor t squared, which is just from the two independent movements of the instantons. But that term will be subdominant to this term at polynomial timescales.
I see.
But if I wait for exponential timescales, of course, this kind of terms will dominate. And we can actually explicitly calculate what will be the expression. And just by some resumming of some terms, you'll get exactly one here on the for gamma less than gamma c as well. Mm-hmm. By some model of instant proliferation.
Thanks
for the question.
I have one question. So is it possible to generalize this calculation to compute Renyi-2 entropy in a subsystem, not the whole system?
Yeah, actually, that is going to be my next.
Okay, thank you.
Right. Yeah, thanks for the question. That gives me a great segue to the next part. So we can actually, so before I get into that, we can think of the mixed phase, this mixed phase where the purity is less than one, as a quantum error correcting code. I mean, which is not a decodable quantum error correcting code, but we can still have many properties which are similar to a quantum error correcting code. And one pretty simple way of understanding this is that we want to store the information which is in the reference R through our system qubits, the system qubits are subject to local errors, which you can think of, or the local measurements, which you can now think of as local errors. But now, the fact that entanglement survives between the system and the reference means, or can be thought of intuitively as, what if I erased the part of the system which were being measured? And still, there is some information that is being stored for the reference R in the part that is not erased. So intuitively, the maximum number of erasers or the measurements that can be done here is given by this, can be thought of as a code distance of this code. And the entropy of the final state can be thought of as determining the rate of this code, which is how many logical qubits can I actually store within the entanglement structure of the system, which is subject to this measurement. So from this picture, we can to actually see whether this picture applies to our system, we need to calculate subsystem entropies as Benny was suggesting. So what is the subsystem entropy? Suppose we want to study the reduced density matrix, the trace rho squared of the reduced density matrix on a subsystem A, which is kn qubits instead of the whole n qubits. And as one can see that there are two boundary effects which are competing here. One is the boundary effect due to the part A, and one is the boundary effect due to the complement of this part A. And the part A has a swap operator acting on those qubits, while part A bar has no swap operator. So we now have a competition between the instanton so far. So as if I plot the phase diagram as a function of gamma and k, where k is the fraction of the qubits which are being in our subsystem entropy calculation. So for gamma less than gamma critical, we have a competition between the instanton configuration and a configuration without the instanton, but which satisfies the boundary condition of the unswapped part. So what we can see is that there is a transition that happens between the no instanton configuration and an instanton configuration at a particular fraction, which is given by Kc, and close to the critical point, we can actually study what is the critical value or critical scaling of this fraction Kc. So what we see is that if I wanted to calculate the subsystem entropy at this point, which is at a high enough K and gamma less than gamma critical, the leading saddle point configuration will come from the instanton. But while at this point, the leading saddle point configuration will come from the non-instanton configuration. And this point actually has ramifications for the quantum error correcting properties. What we can show is that if we calculated the mutual information through this Renyi entropy, this is the quasi-mutual information between a system A bar, which is a complement of A and the reference, then for large enough fraction K, the information between the complement of it and the reference is actually zero. And this comes from the fact that there will be the instanton configuration here will exactly cancel out in the two different terms. And we get, at least at large N, we get a zero mutual information, which means that this KC can be related to the code distance. So what we found is that for polynomial time scales and gamma less than gamma critical, we have a code rate, which is given by the Reni 2 entropy, which is proportional to N. This has come from the large N effect. And then the delta I, which is coming from the instanton configuration. So these are the number of qubits that can be encoded in our system, which are protected from the measurements at, you know, at polynomial time scales. And the code distance, which is given by 1 minus k. So this means that if I erased 1 minus k into n of these qubits, I could in principle recover, at least if I'm understanding recovery in terms of this quasi mutual information expressed in terms of the quasi Reni entropies. And if this statement holds for the actual Reni entropy and even the von Neumann entropy, then we can actually make a statement about the quantum error properties from the eraser of these qubits. But this already gives us a hint about what are the quantum error correcting code properties of those mixed fields.
So criticality, near the criticality, the code distance is almost like maximal, like n over 2, am I?
Yeah.
I see. So it's pretty good. Good, I guess. I'm curious, is this very good code in whatever the sense that, like, yeah, it seems like it's doing very good.
Yeah, I think it's a function of the fact that we are doing power to all circuits.
Mm-hmm.
So like decoding these errors will be very hard.
Yeah, sure, but okay.
Yeah, anyway, but thanks. From this property, it seems like a great code. And actually, if I have time, I'll want to go to the next part, which also has some very intriguing code properties. Okay, are there any questions or more questions? All right, if not, then let me briefly go over the next part, which is when I try to set up these Brownian circuits on a lattice with it's not just all-to-all, but we set these all-to-all clusters to be interacting amongst themselves in some on some lattice. Okay, so the picture, the schematic picture is like this. We have these individual clusters which have these two-body interactions, single-body measurements. But now I connect these clusters through some two-body but intercluster interactions. These are these J tilde terms. And then again, we consider that these J tilde terms are also random and time independent at different times. And in principle, we can also study the local case where these J tildes are only between nearest neighbor clusters on, say, if I set these clusters on a particular lattice. But I can also now study a more general problem where I set these J tildes as some power law. So some power law that goes as r to the minus alpha, where alpha is a power law exponent. And so this is a competition between interactions which are decaying as power law and local measurements, local single body measurements. And we set like L such clusters on a qubit, and each cluster has N qubits. And we take the N goes to infinity limit here. Right. And going by the same technical steps, we now end up with an effective field theory, and I'm not going to spell out all the steps. But if I do the same thing about integrating out the disorder and then introducing Hubbard certain Lewis fields, and then the model simplifies in terms of like what is the subgroup of the replica symmetry group which is important. We end up with a 1 plus 1D anisotropic Ising field theory, and the same replica symmetry breaking field phi. And so we have a time derivative term, which is local. And there's in the space, in the spatial direction, we now have long range interactions. So R and S are the different lattice points, and we have fields at different lattice points, but now they're connected by some long range interaction. So this is the anisotropy. So in the time and space, they're different. And apart from that, we have the similar Ising field theory that we have here. So we have a mass term and we have a phi to the fourth term. So let's try to picture what is happening here. So now we have we can think of them as two-dimensional sheets. So there's a time direction and a space direction. And now there are four copies of the circuits. There's a lighter green, which are the Vs, and the darker greens, which are the V daggers. And by integrating out the disorder, we are ending up with a field theory, which is on again, a two-dimensional slice, but this is just a single sheet. And this is the effective field that captures the information of all these different degrees of freedom on the different replicas. And when we wanted to calculate, so suppose there are any entropy of a particular subregion A, we have to implement a swap operator on a region A. And this shows up as a particular boundary condition on this Ising field theory. And within region A, there is some the red boundary condition, and the region A, the complement of A. This is the other the complement of this is the other boundary condition. So imagine if this was if we took a microscopic model of this Ising field theory, this could be the boundary conditions given by plus one, and the blue would be the boundary condition given by minus one, for example. But now this is an anisotropic Ising field theory. So there will be different effects of that anisotropy on the properties of the Ising field theory, and we'll try to go over that. And the point is that now, because of the different boundary condition in the swapped part, the Reni entropy of this region, for example, suppose I wanted to calculate the Reni entropy of the region A, and I'm looking at, suppose the symmetry broken phase, where there are two degenerate configurations, and this is given by the green and the pink different configurations. And they would be, because of the set boundary conditions, there would be now a domain wall that propagates down into the bulk. And the Reni entropy would be now given by the domain wall tension of this particular domain wall configuration. So just by analyzing that problem, the domain wall problem, the domain wall configuration problem, domain wall tension problem in this anisotropic field theory, we can now actually extract what is the scaling of the Reni entropy at different values of gamma and two and alpha. Note there that alpha becomes 2 alpha because we have taken a random problem, so we have to take the variances scaling as 2 alpha instead of alpha, and that's what enters into the problem. So if we did not take a random problem, we should think of each 2 alpha as being just alpha here. So now in this problem, we see that there is a Ising transition in this model at a particular gamma c, which is a critical gamma, which is given by some function of alpha. In this case, it's the Riemann zeta function of alpha. And so this is the transition line, which diverges at 2 alpha goes to one. So at this point, so what we understand here is that at 2 alpha less than one, the whole system collapses down to a single cluster, effectively a single cluster. So there is no area law, volume law transition. There is still the purification transition, but that won't be captured by a subregion entropy. Now, for 2 alpha greater than one, we have this transition. So, and we see that there is, for alpha greater than 2 alpha greater than two, in fact, there's an area law to volume law transition that occurs. So area law means that the domain wall tension is, and I'll show the domain wall pictures here, where there is a volume law transition. There's a volume law phase for gamma less than gamma critical. And interestingly, for 2 alpha less than two, we find that because of this anisotropic term, there's a correction to the volume law term and an area law term, which is given by A raised to two minus two alpha. And this is a non-perturbative effect. This is not a 1 over n suppressed effect. And this comes just from the fact that the domain wall now gets an effect, acts an extra correction because of this anisotropic term. And just from the picture that I drew before in terms of the domain, the configurations and mean walls. So in the symmetric phase, which is above this dark line, dark black line, there is just a single symmetric saddle point. So the boundary conditions don't have temporal memory. So they immediately go down to the saddle point configuration is just a symmetric saddle point value. But for the symmetry broken phase, which is below this phase transition, there is now two distinct phases which are separated by a domain wall. And this domain wall is now facing tension from two factors. One is the time-like direction, one is the space-like direction. And the space-like direction has this extra effect of the long-range interaction, which now adds to the volume entropy. So this is a correction that comes up from the long-range interaction. And we can also study the critical properties of the transition. Namely, we can see that the dynamical critical exponent, this is the blue line, and this goes as a function of 2 alpha. So it goes from 1, goes from 0 to 1 as 2 alpha is tuned from 1 to 3. So below 2 alpha, for 2 alpha less than 3, this is actually a non-CFT-like transition because there is no conformal symmetry. And also the domain wall tension, which is the sigma in the volume law effect, volume law term, the scaling of this also can be extracted analytically. This is just 3/2, and this is related to the fact that even in the all-to-all case, we had a 3/2 critical exponent coming from. And this effect of the long-range interaction on the entropy is an interesting thing. And this in the area law phase, this fractal phase has actually been identified numerically in this recent paper and even actually more recent papers. But I think the volume law phase, the fact that there is a sub-volume law correction has not been identified before. And so this is just coming from the effective model that we have come up with. And we believe that this is actually a generic effect. And this has actually an impact on the quantum error correcting properties of this phase. And without going through the whole calculation, we again see that the mutual information between a region A and R is zero for all sizes of A less than this particular scaling, so L to the 2 minus 2 alpha. As a summary, what it means is that at polynomial timescales, we again have a code rate, which is the Reni 2 entropy. Suppose we identify the code rate as the Reni 2 entropy, then we have this rate which is linear in the system size, which is L. So by system size here, I mean the number of clusters, and the code distance, which goes as L to the 2 minus 2 alpha. So which means that as you take 2 alpha to 1, this becomes a distance which scales as linearly as L. So this becomes a great code in that sense. But as usual, like this is not a decodable, like we don't know how to decode it, but just in terms of these properties, we can actually tune the code distance in this model here. All right, so that brings me to the end of my talk, and I'll just quickly summarize and be open to take any questions. So just some current directions that I think can be easily pursued within the models that we have introduced. One big question is this, the problem that had been identified in some of the questions, that we are looking at this annealed entropy. And in fact, this is like in all analytical approaches to hybrid dynamics, this is the quantity that has been calculated because this is the quantity that we can calculate. But as I mentioned, that if I take the generalized Reni, the quasi-Reni entropy, and we take the n to 1 limit, that is actually equal to the average von Neumann entropy, average Quenz von Neumann entropy. And this limit was taken by a recent paper by my collaborators in a similar Brownian circuit for fermions, with some, they set up the model in a way that you can take this n equals to 1 limit, you can take the actual replica limit. There's a question that can we take the same limit for qubits? And it's from our from the work that is ongoing, it seems that we could, although it's a much more complicated problem for qubits than for fermions. And even further, suppose we don't want to take the n equals one limit, suppose we want to take the quenched entropy. Suppose we want to just calculate the Rényi entropy, but we want to take the or the purity, and we want to take the average outside the ratio. And then I think such models will be the place to look, and we can think of different methods of trying to take that average. One would be replica trick. We introduce different replicas, and we take some n equals to minus one limit. And the other thing would be try to come up with a model that has some other structure. In disorder physics, there is a notion of supersymmetry. By introducing some extra superfields, we can do this averaging technique to take the average of the ratios properly. And that's also something that I think that is an ongoing work, and I think that can also be accessed in models that, like what we have introduced. Second very interesting direction is, as many of you would be part of this kind of work, where we see that entangling measurements, where we have multi-particle entanglement, multi-particle measurements, can give rise to novel hybrid entanglement phases. And one question is, can we realize them in the solvable Brownian circuits? And I think it is. I think again, the answer is yes. But then the analysis becomes much more harder, and it's not clear whether we can actually retain solvability in some sense once we introduce these other multi-particle measurements. There's other more tangential questions, is like, can we understand other entanglement transitions through this Brownian circuits? For example, can we understand many-body localization? And one step towards that would be considering a Floquet version of the circuits. And one question that we are trying to understand now is, can we retain solvability while considering a Floquet version of the circuit? And before I end, I just wanted to like paint the big picture that we are trying to address here. So in my PhD, I've been thinking mostly about quantum information in many-body systems. And a lot of time, some of my initial works were focusing on scrambling and chaos, and in trying to study tensor network methods to study scrambling and chaos, studying chaos bounds in local systems. And this scrambling and chaos has turned out to be like a very useful organizing principle to study very disparate systems, including quantum many-body quantum condensed matter system models, or AMO physics, or even in quantum gravity. And as a result of the understanding that we derived from scrambling and chaos, we found that we can actually study out of equilibrium scrambling phases using disorder as a tool. That's what the informational phases of many body localization that I worked a little bit on earlier showed, but also this very new phenomenon that we have discovered that the community has discovered recently of many-body of measurement-induced phase transition also falls in this arena of out-of-equilibrium scrambling phases, which derives from the understanding of how scrambling interacts with different things like disorder or measurements. And something that we can hope to understand from these models or these methods that we have introduced is also like, how does thermalization work in general? Can we come up with analytically understandable models of many-body quantum chaos and see how they interact, how they are the same in more numerical approaches that we have seen contexts. And another arena that I'm interested in more and more is like trying to go towards quantum simulation and information processing. A lot of the understanding of quantum information in many-body systems have come from the hope or the promise from quantum simulation that there is now a controllable system where we actually can answer many of the questions that we wanted to answer. And many of the studies in theory have been spurred on by the improvements or the advancements in experiments. But one question that I want to address, or I've been thinking about more recently, is about how we can think about from the other direction, like going from theory back to the experiments. For example, one thing that we have understood from theory is that all-to-all models like SYK models or the Brownian circuit models that we introduced are very, very powerful tools to understand dynamical phases or even equilibrium phases analytically. So can we do quantum simulation of them? And one arena, one frontier that opens up is considering sparse models, where we don't restrict ourselves to lattice models with some locality, but we introduce long-range interactions, but we don't introduce a connected graph as in a psychic model where there is an exponential number of connections, but we have sparse interactions. And it's been, and there's promises to, that we can actually understand many of these models using tensor network methods. And this is something that I'm interested in pursuing and just laying out the big picture here. And this is a circuitous path that will take us from all these different phases, all these different arenas. So thank you for your attention here. And I just wanted to leave the summary of my talk here. So we introduce an analytically solvable model for measurement-induced criticality. We identified replica symmetry breaking as a mechanism responsible for MIPT. And we described a simple mean field description of the phase transition. And by introducing other ingredients like power law long range couplings, we identified quantum error correcting properties which are novel in this setup. And I also pointed out some open questions. One open question is a replica limit. Can we take the entanglement entropy? And there are also the questions of other interesting non-equilibrium entanglement phases. Can we get them through a combination of measurement and scrambling? And also, can we probe MIPT with simpler, more experimentally feasible observables? So with that, I thank you for your attention. And these are the references for my work that I presented.
Okay, thank you for the interesting talk. Are there questions?
Hi, could I ask a question?
Yeah,
thanks for the interesting talk. So in the second half, I think I might have missed something. Could you go to the entanglement phase diagram?
Yeah.
Right. So I guess in the strictly local hybrid circuits, the volume law phase has a subleading power law correction.
Right.
So here somehow it doesn't show up, or
right. So in the Clifford numerics there is a subleading power law correction that shows up, and that would in our picture would show up as a 1/n effect. So that would come from the fluctuation of the disk domain walls, and so indeed there is a power law correction, but I think there has been more recent analytical understanding from Quen's disorder aspect, there has been, I think, understanding. But within our model, that those corrections will be 1/n effect. What we are showing here is that there is a non-perturbative effect that comes up from these models, which just comes up from these long-range interactions. And so it's a tunable power law as opposed to that. So it's actually an interesting question, what happens here in terms of the different power laws that we have probably coming from another source and how that interacts with this power law.
I see, okay, thanks.
Right, in fact, the most obvious, actually there's a problem with the, I was a little too fast, there's a problem with these models in the sense that the subleading terms here actually are logarithmic, they are log L. And that was, there is not the power law that you observe in Clifford numerics. And only by considering a more sophisticated like Quen's disorders, I think there was understanding was developed by Sagar Vijay and Matthew Fisher, and I think Yadong Lee, that there you get those power law terms, but the most obvious term that would come up here is the 1/n suppressed log L term coming from fluctuations. So it's actually a small open question is how can we get or understand the other power law terms within this structure, within these models.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I have a related question. So here in 1+1D, you talked about the time scale that is polynomial in N, but in 1+1D, we expect to have a genuine symmetry broken state in the thermodynamic limit. So
yes.
does that mean this aerial state will survive at arbitrary long time limit, even at finite n?
Yeah, I think that's the understanding here. But I haven't thought very deeply about this, but as you say that in the 1 plus 1D, there's a general symmetry breaking, which is not fragile. I think that this would mean that the volume law phases here are actually stable up to infinite times.
Then what is that polynomial time scale that you mentioned?
Right. Perhaps that's maybe a mistake here. So I think from that understanding, it should be like for all time scales. Yeah, there is no instanton proliferation mechanism here in 1 plus 1D. Yeah.
Okay. So another question, you mentioned the difference between annealed entropy and the quenched entropy. So you have seen this sharp transition, at least in the large n limit from this annealed entropy. So at least can you say the existence or absence of sharp phase transition in the large n limit in the real quenched entropy case? Even that is not known.
So I think in this Brownian circuit models for fermions that was studied recently by Shaukai and Brian, they took the n equals to 1 limit and they found that actually this phase transition survives for all Reni n's. And so they survive up to n equals to 1 limit. But that's I think you asked a question about the annealed versus quenched. That is, there has not been any calculation to show either way. I think that will require some model building where you can take the quenched limit easily. And I think something that I'm thinking about currently is how can we come up with a model where we can take that quenched versus annealed.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's an open question.
But is there a problem? I mean, is there a fundamental difficulty in extending what you're doing here for S2 to Sn for general n?
No. So right. So that was the step that was taken for fermions. It's easier to integrate out fermions. It's a little harder to integrate out qubits because you introduce all the other different fields and I think it's a possible. I think it's a technicality
But as you were saying, the sort of von Neumann entropy, you don't have this difficult difference between the annealed and the quenched version. So if you can do the replica trick for all n, and then you just at the end of the day compute the von Neumann entropy, and then you don't have to worry about this issue, right?
Yeah. For the von Neumann entropy, we don't have to worry about the quenched versus annealed issue. But suppose we wanted to calculate the purity, for example, in the purification transition setup, we want to study the Reni 2 entropy, for example, in that case.
Maybe I don't understand why the purity is defined the way it is. I mean, isn't there a von Neumann version of a purity?
Yeah, I guess, but like the usual way purity is defined is trace rho squared, so you want to have So I mean, if you just take trace rho log rho, that's it. Yeah, that's the von Neumann entropy itself.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tarun? You're muted, Tarun.
He's not totally muted. His just volume is very low, I think.
We don't hear you.
Tarun, I can hear you, but very softly. You have to turn your volume up, I think.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah, I think my microphone was something wrong. Also, it's very late right now. For you, I don't know. If it's really over time, feel free to just not, I don't know.
That's fine, go ahead.
I have just a few things. One question was about, so if I take the 1D circuits which have been studied, which have no long-range interactions with local U-body, just the original, let's say, Lee Chen Fisher paper, there we do have exponentially large time, e to the power n, where after visual purity goes to zero. And then I'm just trying to understand your, at the end, you just mentioned that in this all-to-all coupled system, there may not be such a time because when you have a 1D system because of a 1D Ising model having a stable phase. So, I mean, somehow you're trying to argue that it's necessary to be able to map to some 0 plus 1D system where they are fluctuating instantons. And I know that the local circuits have, there's no such mapping to such anything which you have described, but even then that time scale exists on those, in those models, which have no obvious mapping to a 0 plus 1D system. So yeah. Why that there's an e to the power n time scale in those circuits? And they, that there one can check actually, there is a time scale. Mm-hmm.
So I think there are like various limits here involved. So there is n, which is the local Hilbert space dimension. There is also l.
Right.
So
right.
If I remain at fixed l, there is actually no transition. So that will be the in times which is exponential in l. There will be the transition will be washed out. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a polynomial in l and n.
Okay, I understand.
If we have a...
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
And other question I had was about this. So in normal spin glasses, there is glassiness because of replica symmetry breaking. So what is the analog of, is there such a thing as something is glassy here, or is that just the math technique you're using? There's no.
I don't really know the answer to this. I think there is might be something deeper here that we, there might be something equal, like a more direct connection. We don't really know. There's intriguing connections to even classical spin glasses. Like this, mm-hmm. the glassy states can also be thought of as codes in classical codes.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a. There also the replica symmetry broken state is can be identified as a code. So there are like seems to be like a dictionary which connects them, but what is the underlying structure, I think, is not very clear to me.
Mm-hmm. 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 I see.
Maybe in the sense that ergodicity is broken, they are similar.
Mm-hmm.
So wait, what does ergodicity mean here?
In the path integration, you visit all the configuration with the same action or free energy.
But ergodicity breaking in both spaces, the volume law phase as well as the area law phase. Neither of them satisfy ETH, but it's only one of them which has replica symmetry breaking. But maybe you meant something else. I don't know.
I don't think I understand. I didn't understand the ergodicity breaking part, but.
Maybe one very last thing about the, so the average value of, make sure, so the average value of log of X is bigger than log of average X, right? So the, mm-hmm. So that implies that your average you are actually interested in calculating has some inequality. So at least you can argue one way. Maybe if you find volume law in one thing, it guarantees volume law in another or something like that, right? That follows.
Right.
Without doing any actual work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have to actually now think about which way the inequalities go, but I think.
Yeah, but yeah, average of log X is bigger than log of average X.
Okay.
But it doesn't matter. But there is, I was wondering, are there using some inequalities like these, can you show that the transition is visible in the thing, in the more physical thing, or?
I haven't actually thought about this, but I think that's a useful exercise to do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question.
Okay, great. Thank you for the nice talk, and thank you everyone for the interesting discussion. Okay.
All right. Yeah, thank you everyone.
Yeah, thank you.